Calling Morris Fiorina, who always insists you call him Mo, a distinguished professor of political science, is faint praise. He had an enormously successful career, capped by his appointment as senior fellow of the Hoover Institution and the Wendt Family Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. Then in 2005, rather than rest on his laurels and drift gracefully into dignified professorial irrelevance, he took on the single most popular conventional wisdom of our time, the myth that we have deteriorated into two warring camps on the left and right, with no center remaining in America, the myth that we are polarized. Fiorina then produced a trilogy, Culture Wars? ? In 2005, Disconnect in 2009 on the disconnection between the convictions of the American people and the opinions of their elected officials, and Unstable Majorities in 2017 on the inability of recent administrations, whether Republican or Democratic, to remain in power longer than a couple years, not long enough to fully implement anything resembling a coherent set of policies. I met with Fiorina on the Political Conversation about a year ago, and I thought it was time to resume our talks and gather his reflections on the significance of the results of the 2022 election. So let's dive right into that conversation. This is Wally Knox. Welcome to the Political Conversation. I had an odd thought about how to begin this, and rather than dive into the 2022 election directly, I wanted to begin with an almost offhand comment you made in our first interview, and I may be phrasing this improperly, so take a whack at it. You said you thought one of the reasons why there was disagreement among political scientists on what is going on in the public is that so many of them see the changes that's going on electorally and think it's taking place because of something inside each voter, and that change inside the voters generates the behavior changes and the various changes we're dealing with. And your view was different, that rather the change was in what voters are confronted with. We have very little control over what kind of candidate is going to be presented to us by either of the parties. And your view is that that has changed and voters are responding to a change external to themselves. But that's all you said at that point. And I wonder if you can expand on that so we understand what you're getting at.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think it's the case that most of the political scientists who study voting behavior and public opinion come out of basically we call this the political behavior field. They come out of a social psychological tradition which tends to focus them on the voter, on what's going on in the voter's head. I come out of a different tradition, an economic tradition, which leads me to look more at the real world, what are voters responding to. And can I give an analogy from my last book, which I think captures this difference? And the analogy was this, that you and your wife live in a town where there's only one restaurant. If you want to go out to dinner, you have to go to this restaurant. And it turns out that this restaurant only serves two entrees. Every time you go, there's a beef entree and there's a chicken entree. And when you go, you order the beef and your wife orders the chicken. And various political pundits watching this would say, I have a deep preference for beef. My wife has a deep preference for chicken. We always make that choice. Well, one time you go and the waiter says, the beef dish tonight is liver. And I think, well, I generally like beef, but liver is just too far. I'll have the chicken tonight. Well, think of George McGovern as liver. That I generally vote Democratic, but no, I just can't do it this time. Or suppose you go and the waiter says, tonight, in addition to beef and chicken, we have salmon. And both you and your wife order the salmon. Well, think of Ross Perot as salmon. That basically, and the choices people make reflect the alternatives they're confronted with. And so if the alternatives are consistent election to election, they're probably, most of them are going to make the same choice from election to election. But that doesn't mean they wouldn't switch when given a very different choice. And I think we're in an era where the Democrats basically nominate some sort of liberal in every election. The Republicans nominate some sort of conservative. And so people's choices look very stable, but underneath, they're really not as stable as they look. And the let me stop there. And does that sort of capture what you were asking?
No, I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head. And I wanted to start with that because I think it makes a background for all of the other discussions. And why don't we just turn to that now and see how that pans out? We could update your examples, if you don't mind. The examples you use resonate with me a whole hell of a lot. But there may be others listening to this who wouldn't. So I was thinking, for instance, the Georgia election in which Herschel Walker, the Republican nominee backed by Donald Trump, was rejected by so many, astonishingly, Republican voters who not only didn't vote for Walker, but I read, at least, that 5% of the Republican turnout in Georgia, which was a fairly strong Republican turnout, 5% of Republicans said, I'm voting for Raphael Warnock, which is a pretty significant decision. So it's kind of like tonight it's liver in Georgia if I vote for Herschel Walker, and just not going to go that way.
Yes, that's right.
Let me just open the door wide for you. I've heard you discuss the 2022 election in a couple different forums, and rather than direct you at this point, let me just open the door wide. What for you was really significant in the 2022 election, and do you see any lessons for 2024 coming out of the 2022 results?
The first question is a lot easier than the second one. I think there were a number of interesting features. One of them was simply, it seems to happen every few elections that people rediscover independence. You know, that you go for several elections in which people say it's all partisan, everybody's in one party or another, and then something happens and people say, oh, it's independence. They rediscover them again. You can't just win by mobilizing your partisan base. And there have been a number of articles like that written in the aftermath of the election. And in fact, I think part of it is simply whenever there's a surprise, like basically the Republicans were, by all historical counts, expected to do much better than they did. And when you look down at the data, you find, well, the reason was they, in fact, not only didn't get a big swing from independents, they actually lost independents by a couple points. If you look at all the other big midterm waves, they involved independents swinging in a big way toward one party or the other. The 2000, basically 8-10, or 6-10 wave was 18 points toward the Democrats in one election, 18 points toward the Republicans in the other election. And the independent wave didn't materialize this time. And that's what I think led to the disappointing Republican performance. Now, there's another thing, one of the other interesting things going on. And my colleague, Rui Teixeira, who writes on the Liberal Patriot, has been pointing this out, is the continuing erosion of Democratic support among Hispanics, among Asians, and so forth, that one of the presumptions of the emerging Democratic majority was that the immigrant groups, the diversifying of the country, would result in strengthening the Democratic Party. And that involved two assumptions. One is they wouldn't lose support among existing groups like the white working class, and clearly that's happened. And the other assumption was that the immigrant groups, the newly arrived populations, would continue to vote Democratic at very high rates, and that seems to be more in question. So I think that's the second interesting feature of the election.
And one of the ironic aspects of Teixeira's current view is that he was the author of the idea of an emerging Democratic majority based on demographics, and now is dissenting from his own prior work. Well, actually, that's probably unfair to say, but has added a different take to his original work.
Well, a mark of any good analyst is when new data come forward, you reserve the right to change your mind. But if you look at the book, and we read it in my seminar, there were caveats. And typically the caveats are lost when it enters the public realm and begins being discussed by all the journalists.
So let's stay with the independence for a second, because the discussion of independence has typically followed a certain direction, and that is a lot of people explain away the independent vote. It's almost as if folks want to say there really are no independents in the country. And the underlying basis for that theory is that voters who say they're independent, if they're then asked, is there a political party that you feel closer to, will reply, yes, I feel closer to the Republican Party, or I feel closer to the Democratic Party. And they're classified then as a Republican leaner or a Democratic leaner. And when you do that, you narrow down the independent vote drastically. I looked at the most recent Gallup poll for November, which had a startling number of independents. 42% of the country now say to Gallup, I'm an independent, larger than Democrats at 26% and Republicans at 30%. But if you then start asking them, is there a party that you feel closer to, they give an answer, and they're categorized as leaners. A lot of political commentators see leaners as really nothing other than a member, a loyal member of a party who just doesn't want to say the words. What's your view on that?
I dissent from that view. I have a chapter in the last book dissenting from it. And could I get down in the weeds a little bit on this for a few minutes?
I like the weeds.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
I'm happy there.
The original question is, generally speaking, do you consider yourself a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, or what? And if you consider yourself a Republican or Democrat, you are then asked, do you think of yourself as a very strong Democrat or Republican, or a not so strong? And so then we label people as strong and weak identifiers. Independents are asked, as you pointed out, well, do you feel closer? Now, closer is an ambiguous word. Does that mean in a policy sense or an emotional sense? But set that aside. People who say, I feel closer to the Democrats or closer to the Republicans, well, it turns out if you look at how they vote, they tend to vote with high rates toward the party they lean to. And this led a colleague, John Petrosik, to write an article in the 1970s, early 70s, that's saying they're really closet partisans. They're really just people who don't like to say, I am a member of a party. And then there was one chapter in a book by the Berkeley crowd, which was really oriented toward another subject, but talked about leaners. And that was the main evidence that's been cited for this point of view, that independent leaners are just closet partisans. And I find that younger political scientists today think there is just a lot of proof of that. In fact, there's not. Now, I understand you're going to talk to Professor Vavrick later. I have known Professor Vavrick since she was a teenage research assistant to Warren Miller, who was president at the creation of this question. And I knew Warren well, and many times usually over a good bottle of wine, Warren would say that he regretted they ever asked the follow-up questions. and the reason was he thought the first question, do you consider yourself, that really captured the partisan identity. And if people said they were an independent there, they were an independent. He said he worried that the second question, the probes, really just captured what was going on in the current campaign. So a Democrat in 1964 might say, I'm really a strong Democrat. I mean, the opponent is Goldwater. Whereas in 1972, that same person might say, well, I'm a not so strong Democrat because McGovern is the candidate this time. And by the same token, the independents, and my colleague Phil Shively made this argument, independent says, well, I'm voting for Obama, so I guess I lean toward the Democrats. And so the causality is going the reverse direction among independents. It's not partisanship causing vote. It's vote causing how you respond to the question. And so do I think that some of the partisans, some of the independents are closet partisans? Well, yes, certainly, but nowhere near all of them. And there's plenty of other evidence that says they're not. For example, when you look at the same people over time, and I've done this extensively, The person who says, I'm an independent leading Republican and vote for Eisenhower in 1956, then turns out in 1960 to say, I'm an independent leading Democrat and I'm voting for Kennedy. And you find that when you look at the same people over time, that people move in and out of the independent categories at much higher rates than they move out of the partisan categories, which is consistent with Phil Shively's argument that their vote is influencing the way they answer the question. And so my view is that that some of them are closet partisans, some of them are pure independents, that the pure independents, the ones who answer the question typically are usually like 10 to 12%. How much beyond that, I don't know. The point I'd make about independents is that they are a very heterogeneous category, that some of them are centrists, that some of them are, frankly, just clueless. They have no idea what's going on, and so they say, I'm an independent. Some of them are closet partisans. Some of them are cross-pressured. If I want to vote for a party that is going to lower my taxes, I also have to vote for the party that's going to outlaw abortion. So you have people who are cross-pressured between the two parties. You have people who don't like either party for whatever reason. And so the one thing they have in common, however, is that they're volatile, that they are not tied in to the two parties. They switch around. And so they provide the, along with some of the weak partisans, they provide the change that occurs from election to election.
So your description of the independents reminds me of a major paper that Professor Vavrick and her colleague, Krista Sanovich, co-authored with a small flotilla of other political scientists in 2022, the same year that they published The Bitter End, with the title Moderates. I don't know if you're familiar with that particular paper. It's very interesting, and they go into moderate voters and structure them very much the way you were describing independents. They create three categories, and find that those three categories do a really excellent job of describing moderate voters. Moderates who are true moderates. They're just going to be sort of 50-50 on issue after issue. They're a moderate. Moderates who are conflicted. I feel strongly about abortion rights. I don't feel strongly about some other issue, or I'm different on that other issue. They're conflicted. And then moderates who, as you were just saying, are just kind of out of it. They're not paying attention to politics. They know very little about politics, and they may not vote because they're just not engaged in political activity. So they authored that paper and were focusing on moderates, but there seems to be an awful lot of an overlap with the independent structure. Do you see that happening?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, all these categories, it makes it less likely that you're going to say, I'm a committed Democrat or I'm a committed Republican, that there are reasons why you just hesitate to put yourself in those categories.
Looking ahead, if you don't mind, I mean, the next step is to wonder what the heck's going to happen in 2024. Out of the 2022 results with the quote-unquote re-emergence of the independents, what's your guess?
I'm notoriously bad at this. My colleagues laugh at the fact that I've been predicting the breakup of the two parties for the last 20 years or so, and it just doesn't happen. So it's probably just wishful thinking on my part. But I mean,
there may be a few others who have the same wish, but
but it is clear that both parties have tremendous internal tensions, especially after the disappointing performance of the mega Republicans. That clearly a big debate is going on in the Republican Party, and by the same token, as you pointed out, Teixeira's argument about how we better get back to the middle on a lot of these issues or we're facing really bad situation in the days to come, conflicting with the progressives. Yeah.
Teixeira speaking as a convinced Democratic Party supporter who's concerned, right, you know, about the Democratic Party. But there's another whole issue that concerns me, and that's something that concerns me about the whole polarization view that the country is polarized into hostile camps. And that goes into the whole question of whether we're governable or not. It concerns me that to think that we truly have divided into completely separate camps with moderates vanishing, independents vanishing. Folks who believe that are close to saying that there's a flaw in the Democratic project, that the Democratic project, I think the way I explained this at one point was that democracy has never been universally adopted and universally agreed to, and there have been strong arguments against democracy. Well, if in fact we're polarizing, there's a whole new argument against the democratic project, and that is that democratic electorates polarize and become ungovernable.
Well, fortunately, that argument is wrong. It's a misperception among the 5% of the country who think Twitter is the real world. And the fact of the matter is, most Americans are not divided in these extreme camps. And even on issues that divide the parties like abortion, I've been saying this for 25 years, that most of the country is in between the Democratic and Republican parties on abortion. The point is, they never get the middling alternative. I think they had the middling alternative, which was Roe. That was very interesting. The two-thirds of the country basically said, I can live with Roe. And it's only when you try to go to one side or the other that you get a big majority. But that's what the two wings of the two parties keep trying to do. And I think the same issues comes up in like transgender rights and so forth, that if you're offered only extreme alternatives, then you have to sort of make a decision between extreme alternatives. But the process today, I worry about the health of democracy, but it's not the voters I worry about. It's the so-called leaders who keep, basically, who are either a bunch of just they're trying to raise money and raise their public profiles, or they really are true believers, which is maybe even worse, and really are trying to impose these extreme policies on a broader, more moderate public. And it's not that people don't disagree. It's just that in many cases, they could reach some middling compromise and say, okay, let's move on from there.
I think we have to go back and discuss your reference to Roe a bit, because I suspect there's a whole bunch of folks out there who identify the Roe decision with simply being for abortion rights. We hear that rhetoric over and over again, and opposition to Roe means you're against abortion rights. Can you flesh out your point about the Roe decision?
Sure. I think, for one thing, if you look at Roe, broadly speaking, it was the Supreme Court reaching the compromise that was the political system was incapable of reaching for various reasons. And I mean, Justice Scalia accused O'Connor of reading the opinion polls, and he was right that basically the things they passed were things that had majority opinions, majority support. The things they said weren't okay were things that didn't have majority support. And people said, I mean, there was great weeping and gnashing of teeth on the part of the extremes, but basically people thought, I can live with that. And all over the years, basically the public opinion data has been clear. Majorities are uncomfortable with second-term abortions, and they're really uncomfortable with third-term abortions. Majorities consistently want exceptions, even in the third trimester, for rape, incest, the health of the life of the mother, and so forth. And so basically, people were okay. They could live with Roe. And it's only when sort of suddenly the whole arena becomes open again and people are saying, well, no abortion after 10 weeks or no abortion, or they want to have abortion up to basically the time of birth, that's when the controversy just spins totally out of control.
But the issue now with the Supreme Court rejecting Roe as governing law for the entire country has been thrown back into the lap of each of the states. And one commentator, Ron Brownstein, looking at the 2022 election, made a comment that I took as directed to Democrats who were feeling very good about the results, in large part because it had been anticipated that there would be a massive Republican victory in the House of Representatives, and that completely failed to appear. And then there were stunning senatorial successes. So there's a lot of optimism in a Democratic Party, which ironically lost control of the House of Representatives. But Brownstein cautioned that what he saw was there was not one election, there were two elections. One took place in blue states and swing district states, which was generally Democratic in orientation, and the other election took place in red states. And what Brownstein saw happening there was high turnouts, red voting, and no apparent backlash to extreme positions on abortion in particular. And Brownstein speculated that we're going to see more of that in 2024 and years beyond. What's your take on Brownstein's observation?
Well, hard to say. I mean, New York, they weren't in it. New York was a disappointing Democratic year, but see, nobody in New York worried about abortion being restricted. Just that legislature's not going to do that. I think there were so many things at play in the election that I think it's really hard to draw general lessons out of it, and really hard to project what happened in this election down the road to 24. That's the job of people like Brownstein, but I just feel very, that's not my job. I'll say after 24 what I think happened. And,
I think we're all in that boat. It's a strange time politically. It really is. We've been discussing, interestingly, of Lynn Vavreck's views in particular, and how those compare with your views. And I have, because I'm interviewing you now and because I'm preparing to interview Professor Vavreck, Lynn Vavreck, shortly, I've been paying attention to what your writings are. And I was struck by two things. Tremendous overlap in what you see happening and your description of what's happening. In particular, have the parties polarized? Oh, yeah. And what does that mean? And lots of agreement on what it means to say that the parties, the electeds, have polarized. But a parting of the ways on whether that means that there's no center left in the American public. And I wanted to just invite you to give your general comments on that structure. And is there consensus, and is it really factual that there is a polarization taking place in the country among elected officials, among party activists, and among a portion of the electorate, but that it's not reflected in the electorate as a whole, and that that's a major flaw in the analytic thinking of academics?
First, just let me say that it's encouraging that people could look at the data and arrive at similar conclusions. That suggests that it's not just all partisanship and personal political views, that we're making decisions based on the evidence. I don't think there's a lot of disagreement. I think within the profession at large, there is universal agreement that the political class is polarized, that if you look at elected officials, if you look at the donors, the party activists, that they have definitely polarized. That's why I say it's important to call it party polarization, that it's taken place along party lines. Now, there's a much bigger disagreement among how deeply this goes into the electorate. And, the distinction I always make is about sorting versus polarization. It's not that voters have become any more extreme on abortion. It's just that all the pro-life people are now in the Republican Party, and all the strongly pro-choice people are now in the Democratic Party. That wasn't the case 20 years ago. Same thing for guns, same thing for gays, etc. That there has been a sorting out, even though the positions haven't become more extreme, and that has resulted in greater party polarization. And again, it's not nearly as extreme among the voters as it is among the sort of this slice of people, maybe 15% of the people we call the political class. But nevertheless, that sorting has always also taken place.
All right. I wanted to go back to the independent topic, if you don't mind, and let me ride a hobby horse of my own on that. And I haven't had a chance to discuss this with you previously. One of the things about the discovery of independent leaners that concerned me was that it happens as a follow-up question. The data talking about leaders is usually generated by a poll which first asks, as you were sort of saying, are you a Republican, an independent, or a Democrat? And then the pollster turns to the independents and says, do you feel closer to one party or another? First time I heard that description, my instantaneous reaction was, the surveyor is saying to that person, you just told me you're an independent. Really? Isn't it true that there's one party or another that you really are closer to? Now, and then they get results that, yes, I'm leaning, yes, I'm closer. And the whole debate about hidden partisans emerges from that set of questions in which the voter is challenged about their view. That's not done with Democrats and Republicans. They're asked a follow-up question, but the follow-up question is, are you a strong Democrat or a weak Democrat? Are you a strong Republican or a weak Democrat? They aren't challenged to disavow being a Republican or being a Democrat. Now, I just speculate, and I cannot imagine that you're going to go out on a limb and speculate along with me, but I have to say this. If someone conducted a poll and turned to the person who just said, I'm a Republican, and said, you're a Republican, but is it true that you're closer to Republicans or closer to independents? What would happen? What kind of statistics would be generated by that? Would every single Republican say, oh, I would never feel closer to being an independent? Or would there be a percentage of Republicans who would say, yeah, I'm a Republican, but frankly, I feel closer to the independents?
I think if there are any young professors or graduate students listening, they ought to design a survey question and get it out there in the field right now. This would be a real interesting paper to write. I agree completely that I think I remarked in the last book that I don't know of any other question in survey research where somebody gives you an answer and the analyst that says, no, you're not. I'm going to put you in this category, that we actually reject what they said, and we say, no, I'm coding you as a Democrat when I do my statistics. And that, I say that's really highly unusual, maybe unique, and I think it's wrong.
Well, I'll offer my services to, I'll be a good graduate student aide to that poll when it's conducted. But I'd be fascinated to see the results on that. I mean, not only that, but I mean, when people say I'm a weak Democrat, what's the difference between a weak Democrat and a strong independent? That's a hard one for me to figure out.
Mm-hmm. This goes way back to one of the questions you asked earlier. Actually, the question you led off with about how I see voters' responses as much more determined by the reality they're facing than what's going on inside their heads. An example of that is their analyses of swing voters, which say they've declined. And what they point out is that there were far more voters who switched their votes between, say, 1972 and 76 than between, say, 2004 and 2008, or 2000 and 2004, the National Election Study panels. And my observation is simply that a voter in 1972 was facing Nixon McGovern. In 1976, the voter was facing Carter Ford. Four different candidates across the four-year period. In 2000 versus 2004, they're facing the same Republican, and Kerry and Gore look an awful lot like the same Democrat. And so why would you expect fewer people to swing? Why wouldn't you expect fewer people to swing between 2000 and 2004 than between 1972 and 76? That the difference in the candidates strikes me as a perfectly plausible explanation for what went on there.
So the 2022 election, there are two ways that voters can, quote unquote, be inconsistent in their party loyalty. One is a swing voter, meaning in this year I voted Democratic, next year I'll vote Republican. I'm swinging from one party to the other between years. But in the same year, this year, 2022, there was an emergence of the switch voter. Split-ticket voting really emerged with force, at least in one contest, and that was the Georgia contest.
Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. All right. Can you? What was your perception of those races?
Same thing. First of all, governors tend to be, the gubernatorial elections, less nationalized than Senate elections. That governors often can sort of avoid some of the national issues and focus more on state welfare and state issues. But nevertheless, you had in Pennsylvania, as Mitch McConnell would say, a low-quality gubernatorial candidate. You also had a low-quality Senate candidate, but nevertheless much higher quality than the gubernatorial candidate. And Georgia, same thing, a very low-quality Senate candidate. And that when that happens, people will switch. It's just typically not the case that you have such a disparity in candidate quality across the two levels. But when it presents itself, voters will in fact make the decision. But it's also rational for voters not to. I mean, people sometimes say, why would anybody vote for Herschel Walker? Well, it's also the case that the individual candidates don't matter as much anymore, honestly, that if you just go to Congress and you vote the way the party leadership says, and the committee chairs are really under the control of the party leadership, that it really doesn't matter if your candidate, your senator, is as high quality today as it would have been 30 years ago. Also, earmarks were banned for a while there and so forth. And so there are real reasons why voters shouldn't put as much emphasis on the individual candidate in a party-defined era as they did in a more, we used to call it, what was it called? It was a more individualistic era.
You made a quick comment there that went by really fast, but I find it interesting, and that is the role of earmarks in these races and earmarks. Why don't you lay that out for listeners who may not be familiar with the concept of earmarks?
Okay, earmarks were typically in appropriations bills, where a senator or House member would insert language that said a certain grant or a certain project should be given to this district or this state. And, you know, I mean, if you go back in the heyday of earmarks, if you go back and look at the Senate in the Lyndon Johnson's day, all these Western senators would vote very liberally. And you'd wonder, gee, these people didn't really have any African-Americans in their districts. Well, Lyndon Johnson would call up and say, hey, I need your vote. I'll give you a damn. You know, and so it was a fair trade for people. And constituents like that, you know, constituents, I wrote about this in one of my earlier books, Constituency Service, about how an incumbent, by virtue of achieving seniority, a good position, good constituency position, could deliver for the district. Now, the Republicans actually did away with earmarks, and that took away, another colleague, Diana Evans, wrote a book on this, that it made legislating much more difficult. I think it got out of hand. We had the Bridge to Nowhere and things like that, where there was simply no reason to do this other than to spend money. But nevertheless, they were a valuable way of sort of lubricating the gears of the legislative process. But once you do away with the individual member's ability to deliver for the district, then incumbency is not so important, seniority is not so important. That basically, do you want Nancy Pelosi or do you want Kevin McCarthy to be Speaker of the House? That becomes a more important consideration than your individual member. The incumbency advantage has dropped steadily over the last 20 years, and I think that's a reflection of the fact that the individual incumbent simply doesn't matter as much anymore as it used to.
So the irony of the observation about earmarks is that earmarks are a classic example of bad government in a lot of political literature. So earmarks are universally despised by anyone who talks about them. They're an example of corruption. They distort the political process, but they seem to have played a role with getting things done at one period in our history.
For a very long period in our history. I think there are a lot of things now that people look back on and think, maybe it wasn't totally right to get rid of these things, like the smoke-filled room where the party bosses chose the candidates. They didn't come up with some of the people we're coming up with today, although there really aren't any party bosses anymore, so we couldn't really go back to those days even if we wanted to.
Yeah, I can't resist asking you about this. There was a leadership selection among Republicans, selecting a Speaker of the House, and there was a leadership decision in the Democrats in the House, polar opposites in how they were conducted, with the Republicans a massive public spectacle in which it took them ages to select the inevitable leader, Kevin McCarthy, for Speaker. I doubt there are 12 Americans outside of the journalist and political science profession who are even aware that there was a selection on the Democratic Party side. But, I mean, bluntly, I have to say I've been very impressed with Hakeem Jeffries, who was the new Democratic leader among the Democrats. Have you followed that process at all?
About as much as every other political scientist, and with great confusion for a lot of the time, and not as much understanding as I would have liked.
Well, thanks for joining us again, Mo. I wish us a happy and eventful 2023. I don't think it'll go by peacefully and serenely.
Thank you.
I loved Mo's story of the town with only one restaurant. He hit on a way to make clear the difference between thinking that all changes in what voters do is the result of some change deep inside their minds, and realizing that, in reality, they were offered different choices.
You and your wife live in a town where there's only one restaurant, and it turns out that this restaurant only serves two entrees. Every time you go, there's a beef entree and there's a chicken entree. And when you go, you order the beef and your wife orders the chicken. Well, one time you go and the waiter says, the beef dish tonight is liver. And I think, well, I generally like beef, but liver is just too far. I'll have the chicken tonight. Well, think of George McGovern as liver. I generally vote Democratic, but no, I just can't do it this time. Or suppose you go and the waiter says, tonight, in addition to beef and chicken, we have salmon. And both you and your wife order the salmon. Well, think of Ross Perot as salmon. That basically, and the choices people make reflect the alternatives they're confronted with.
Because the candidates we're forced to choose from are so predetermined, our politics shows very little change. One group of us votes for beef. The other votes once again for chicken. Beef may win this time, chicken the next, but always by tiny, utterly undependable margins, margins that vanish 2 years later. And all the while, most of us are longing for salmon. You may disagree with Mo, but he is a master at presenting his view with utter clarity. To assess the significance of the 2022 elections, I'm having three conversations. First, I just spoke with Mo Fiorina. Soon, I will speak with Professor Lynn Vavrick of UCLA, who has just published The Bitter End with co-authors John Sides of Johns Hopkins and Chris Tosanovich of UCLA, and then with Professor Joan Williams of Hastings College of the Law. Lynn Vavrick led a massive survey of 500,000 voters in the 2020 election, which produced highly detailed information about our political convictions and our behavior, which she then presented in The Bitter End. In addition to that fine detail, The Bitter End is a sweeping review of the 2020 election, written with the compelling storytelling of a novel. It'll be the touchstone report on that election for years to come. Fiorina and Vavrick present their views as political scientists who are not advocates of either of the parties. My third guest in the trilogy, Joan Williams, is different. Just 4 months after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, Williams published White Working Class, a blistering attack on the Democratic Party presented by a passionate supporter of the party. She laid out just how completely her own party had abandoned white working people and in 2016 had been repudiated by those same folks. I'll ask her to revisit her work, bring it up to date, and apply it to the 2022 election. If you listen to all three, I hope you'll come away with an understanding of the spread of the best of current political theory and how it applies to our political contests. And if you're a concerned Democrat, you'll be challenged to think critically about your own party.